imperialist war of aggression against Syria has been raging on now for almost a decade. Foreign actors haven't interfered just on the battlefield. They've also been waging a war of words and ideas using a vast propaganda network. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2011, during the so-called Arab Spring, what started out in Syria as a supposed popular uprising or a revolution quickly turned out to be a very complex proxy war involving numerous actors, very powerful Western governments, and Arab kingdoms in the Persian Gulf. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States worked together to fund and train hardline Islamist groups inside of Syria in order to implement regime change and overthrow the Syrian government. These groups were supplied with radios, medical equipment, weapons, munitions, and much more. However, the war against Syria hasn't been waged just with weapons and just on the battlefield. It's also involved words, ideas, propaganda. And so these nations wielded the power of the mainstream media in order to craft a certain narrative and change public opinion about what is going on inside of Syria. One of the biggest lies of this war is the alleged gas attack that took place in Douma, a scandal that continues to this day. In April 2018, we heard allegations that the Syrian army had dropped chemical weapons on civilians in Douma. Now at this time, the Syrian army was undertaking Operation Damascus Steel to take back the region of Ghouta, which is in the countryside of Damascus. Most of Ghouta was already back under the government's control. So why would they use chemical weapons when they're winning this campaign? That makes absolutely no sense strategically or militarily. Why would the Syrian government do the one thing that would guarantee foreign intervention and a bombing campaign by the US and the UK? That makes absolutely no sense. Moreover, the Syrian government had already gotten rid of its chemical weapons stockpile in 2014, which was overseen by the international community. So where are these weapons coming from exactly? Nonetheless, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, sent a fact-finding mission to Douma to investigate what had taken place. Thanks to leaked emails published by WikiLeaks in late 2019, we can see how the OPCW doctored its own reports to remove the findings of the team that it sent to Douma. Why? Because these findings showed that no chemical gas attack had taken place. Bit by bit, we saw how inspectors complained internally that what was being shown in the preliminary report did not match what they found on the ground. The fact-finding mission that was sent by the OPCW concluded that the gas cylinders were not dropped from an aircraft, but had been placed there manually. The inspectors also concluded that there were only trace quantities of chlorine. These could have emanated from household items like bleach. Moreover, the medical examinations showed that the victims, the symptoms that they exhibited did not match those of a chemical gas attack. The OPCW leadership removed these findings from their report because they disproved these allegations that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons. One of the whistleblowers who came forward with these revelations is Ian Henderson. And when he did, the OPCW tried to discredit him, which is absurd considering the fact that Henderson is a veteran inspector at the OPCW and was leading the mission that went to Douma.
The findings in the final FFM report were contradictory, were a complete turnaround with what the team had understood collectively during and after the Douma deployments. And by the time of release of the interim report in July 2018, our understanding was that we had serious misgivings that a chemical attack had occurred.
20 OPCW inspectors expressed their concerns about the report being doctored. And the OPCW then decided to replace the fact-finding mission with a new one. An entirely new team was assembled with members who had not been to the site, save for one medical expert. The evidence is clear. The science is clear. The chemical weapons inspectors themselves from the OPCW could not find any evidence of a chemical gas attack. This has never been corrected by the OPCW nor the mainstream media. As a matter of fact, the United Kingdom, the United States, France didn't even wait for the OPCW report, for this doctored report to even come out. They just went right ahead and bombed Syria a few days later in April 2018. And last month in October, these same countries blocked Jose Bustani, the former director of the OPCW, from testifying at the UN Security Council.
Of particular concern are the circumstances surrounding the OPCW's investigation of the alleged chemical attack in Douma, Syria, on April the 7th, 2018. These concerns are emanating from the very heart of the organization, from the very scientists and engineers involved in the Douma investigation. Now, almost 1 year later, the OPCW has still not responded to these requests, nor to the ever-growing controversy surrounding the Douma investigation. Rather, it has hidden behind an impenetrable wall of silence and opacity, making any meaningful dialogue impossible. The inspectors in the Douma investigation have a simple request, that they be given the opportunity to meet with you, Mr. Chairman, to express their concerns to you in person, in a manner that is both transparent and accountable. If the OPCW is confident in the robustness of its scientific work on Douma and in the integrity of the investigation, then it should have little to fear in hearing out its inspectors. If, however, the claims of evidence suppression, selective use of data, and exclusion of key investigators, among other allegations, are not unfounded, then it's even more imperative that the issue be dealt with openly and urgently.
When Bustani was the head of the OPCW during the Bush years, John Bolton came to The Hague personally and threatened him and his family if he did not resign, because he was getting in the way of Washington's attempts to topple Saddam Hussein and go for regime change in Iraq. And so when Jose Bustani tried to testify at the UN Security Council and plead that the OPCW listen to its own inspectors and look at the science, look at the evidence from the Douma site, he was blocked. I don't think the irony is lost on anyone that in the same chamber, the same body, in front of the UN Security Council in 2003, Colin Powell sat there and lied about weapons of mass destruction that Iraq did not possess. And here we are 17 years later, in front of the same body, and we're seeing the same movie being played out. How anyone can believe allegations about WMDs emanating from Western governments after 2003 is truly beyond me. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
One of the key voices in amplifying these allegations of chemical weapons being used, and not just in Douma, by the way, are the White Helmets. You may have heard about the White Helmets or seen their videos where they're running in the midst of battle and rescuing victims from the rubble, being portrayed as these benevolent actors. But the truth is far more sinister than that. Just recently, a trove of leaked documents revealed in detail how the United Kingdom and its allies poured millions of pounds into contractor groups. These contractor groups were created by former British intelligence and set up in countries near Syria like Turkey and the United Arab Emirates. They included groups like ARC or IncoStrat, Albany, and all of them founded by figures with backgrounds in British intelligence, in the British military, or the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. These organizations were not only created by Western intelligence, they were funded by the same countries trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. These groups like ARC worked very closely with Western mainstream media in order to craft this narrative about the war in Syria and change public opinion. They pushed the line that Syria and Russia are evil and amplified the voices of opposition figures, and even tried to rehabilitate the image of hardline Islamist groups as moderate rebels. So while the Western media tried to portray the White Helmets as these noble humanitarian actors, and Netflix even produced an Oscar-winning documentary, and they were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. What the Western media never told you is that their founder, James Lemessurier, is not a Syrian. He's British former intelligence and former army. And all these Western cutouts that were funding the White Helmets and running their social media accounts and trying to rehabilitate the image of jihadists as moderate rebels were being run and funded by the same governments trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. That part was conveniently left out, as were the parts about the White Helmets participating in executions on video and using the same offices and headquarters as Al-Nusra Front, which is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. I'm joined by Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett. Eva, you spent a long time in Syria. You covered Douma and the White Helmets. Could you tell us more about your time there?
I first went to Syria in April 2014. I spent a couple of weeks there with a peace delegation, and afterwards came back on a journalist visa in June 2014. And since then, I've been to Syria 14 times. At points during 2016, I was spending 2 months, and then later on 2 months.
You did a lot of coverage on the White Helmets. You've received a lot of attacks because of this in the mainstream media. Why is that? What did you discover exactly about the White Helmets that they don't like?
Yeah, I mean, I would also just add to it, the mainstream media doesn't like to hear anything from Syrian civilians that doesn't mesh with their narrative on Syria, which is, you know, everything about the Syrian government and army bad, everything about their precious quote-unquote rebels good. And so what other journalists, primarily Vanessa Bealey, as you know, and myself have discovered is that the White Helmets are not the virtuous rescue team that their backers would have us believe. They're heavily funded by Western governments, working hand in hand with Al-Qaeda and other extremists in Syria. And you know, this is all right from information that's available online. But then when you talk to Syrian civilians, they'll tell you about how they, for example, could not get close to the White Helmets because they were not allowed to. I was told that by numerous civilians, which begs the question, how are the White Helmets rescuing so many people if civilians tell us that we can't go near them because there's always with the terrorist groups? Civilians also spoke of White Helmets going with terrorists and staging scenes that presumably were like some sort of rescue scene, instead of throwing smoke bombs and then pretend rescuing people. I mean, this is civilian testimony, but I did hear it numerous times. And they, in Aleppo in 2018, an older man I spoke with near the citadel told me, quote, he said the civil defense, which is the name they go by, is supposed to rescue people, but they used to steal women's earrings from their dead bodies. She was wearing gold, they cut her hand to steal it. They're thieves, not rescuers. We saw them murdering people many times. So, and I also was in Eastern Ghouta some weeks after the allegations of a chemical attack having occurred there, and I spent a few hours walking around different districts, Douma, Kapakna, Sakba, talking with people, and I was asking, of course, you know, did they have any information about whether or not a chemical attack had occurred, because you would assume living in those areas, they'd either experienced it or their loved ones in the area had experienced it. And none of them had anything to say. They all thought it was, they either didn't have anything to say or they thought no attack had occurred. Some speculated that it was Jaish al-Islam trying to intimidate them, which was a common thing that terrorists do, by the way. They intimidate civilians there by saying, you know, if you leave this area, the Syrian government or the Syrian army is going to murder you, rape your women. So some are speculating that at the time that they were being, you know, intimidated by Jaish al-Islam. But most of them wanted to tell me about how horrible their lives had been under, whether it was Jaish al-Islam or Falah al-Khan or whichever, you know, how they'd been starved and tortured and how there was point-blank executions in the streets for all to see. So this is the kind of thing that most of the people I was meeting wanted to tell me about. But I did ask them about White Helmets. And so, for example, again, I heard that they were only working with terrorist groups, Jaish al-Islam. They were supposed to be for civilians, but they were the contrary. And one guy said, Jaish al-Islam used to attack us wearing a white helmet one day, and leaving it behind another day. And so I have other testimonies from people from those areas. But also, I think just one other thing to note is that in Douma, in the medical point, the underground makeshift hospital that we all saw in White Helmets and other clips purporting to be treating civilians that were allegedly attacked with a chemical weapon, I spoke with medical staff there who told me, as this is now a very well-known story, but anyway, he said, you know, what staff were treating were people that were coming in for normal shelling injuries, suffocation injuries, gas or dust inhalation. I asked them, like, were any of the staff wearing protective uniforms if they had allegedly been treating chemical weapons victims? He said, of course not. And I said, well, were any of the staff ill or anything like that? And he said, no. And he said, all the people that they treated that day were sent home.
The BBC released a new radio podcast where they tried to whitewash the image of James Le Mesurier and the white helmets, and in it they attacked you and they attacked Vanessa Beely. What are some of the other smears that they put in there?
Right, so I have to be honest, I haven't listened to the whole thing because it's appallingly awful and it's really painful to listen to. But they're running with a theme that, again, that the white helmets are victims of an attack campaign led by Russia, and that myself and Vanessa and other people are under the thumb of Russia and Syria, and that we don't really know what we're doing kind of thing, and that we're just like allegedly just reading a script provided to us. This is the essence of what they're trying to purvey, even though Vanessa, as you know, has many video interviews with civilians on the white helmets, and I have also. But the other funny thing was that, and it might seem like a minor point, and I personally don't care a whole lot, but it was just funny that in one of the episodes, they interviewed Sean Penn, a well-known actor, and he claims to have met Vanessa, and he describes her, I'm going to paraphrase, he didn't know if he was talking to a crazy activist, a Russian agent, or somebody who was perhaps telling the truth. Roughly what he said. But the thing was, he didn't meet Vanessa Beely. I met him in late 2016. It was when I was in the US doing the speaking tour after I had left Aleppo in November 2016, and the city had been under intense terrorist attack. And so in my speaking tour, I was talking primarily about the suffering civilians in Aleppo were enduring under these bombardments, you know, with mortars, missiles, gas canister bombs, etc. And so I was touring and I was in LA, and it was arranged for me to meet with Penn. And we met in his home for a couple of hours. And he seemed receptive to information on Syria. He had been there at least once, I was told. He seemed to be interested in what I had to say. It was with a great deal of surprise that he later described me as, that I learned that he described me as, you know, oh, crazy activist, I'm used to, but like a Russian agent, like, come on. But so I did tweet at him. I haven't gotten a response. But the main point was, again, it's not about me. The point is, if you don't even know who you met in 2016, you know, Vanessa is considerably taller, as I said, blonder, more British than I am. And if he cannot remember that detail, how are we supposed to take as credible anything that he has to say about, you know, Syria, much less the White Helmet?
Did the BBC actually ever provide any evidence to refute your reporting?
No, it's never. It's always character assassination. And you mentioned a previous smear. There was a December 2017 smear by The Guardian, who had their expert, who happened to be a fashion and tech expert, approach us with a very incriminating series of questions about our relationship to the Syrian, Russian, and in my case, DPRK governments, and whether we had any funding by them, and how we were able to go to these countries. And of course, the insinuations were that we're stooges of these governments, right? But then the ensuing character assassinations ensuing smears or reports that they issue are character assassinations. And they don't look at, for example, the testimonies of what Syrian civilians are saying about the conduct of the white helmets, or seeing them walking with various terrorist factions, or the fact that white helmets' headquarters are almost always inevitably next door to Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. or other terrorist headquarters. They don't look at any of that. They sling the slurs, you know, Russian agent, conspiracy theorist, a blogger, you know.
In the Western media, you know, the white helmets are portrayed as these impartial humanitarian actors. You visited the complexes, the offices that they used in Syria. Can you tell us more about what you found there?
I mean, to be honest, I've gone to two. One was in Eastern Ghouta, in Saqqaba, and it was 200 meters down the lane of a bomb-producing, bomb-manufacturing factory. I believe that was belonging to Falah al-Rahman. And the other one was in, headquarters I visited was in Al-Ansari, Eastern Aleppo. And it was in a school, and now the school has been rehabilitated to its normal function, but it was also just down the lane, like half a minute's walk from Al-Qaeda headquarters. And the point also that a local journalist in Aleppo made was that, civilians could not access those areas. If they dared to come to those areas, they would be shot dead by the terrorists, because these were terrorist headquarters areas, and it was well known. So that's just another that point, if we're meant to believe that these rescuers, so-called, are interacting with people and saving them, then why is it that time and again, even before Aleppo was liberated, I spoke with a family that had managed to flee eastern Aleppo in November 2016, and they told me they had tried many times before eventually fleeing. And when I asked them, do they know anything about the White Helmets or the Syrian civil defense, they said no. And when I asked people in greater Aleppo who had loved ones and friends and relatives in eastern Aleppo under their rule of terrorist groups, whether they knew about White Helmets or civil defense, they said no, right? So, I mean, how is that possible? And Richard, if I can make one point, I lived in Gaza. I worked with Palestinian medics in the war in Gaza in 2009. And so I was in very shoddy ambulances rushing to the scene of an Israeli terrorist attack. And basically, there was no time for theatrics. The medics got out of their ambulances, grabbed the body, assisted the people, and got the heck out of there. And so when I watch these videos with White Helmets, I just think, even if you don't know anything about, medical treatment, just watching them, and they're full of theatrics. It's just implausible in a zone under bombings that they would act this way. There's no time. So that's another personal point, that these Palestinian rescuers, they're heroes, but you don't see them doing these types of theatrics is the best word for it, really.
You were in Douma, in Ghouta, shortly after this alleged gas attack in April 2018, and you spoke with residents and with medical staff who were there. What did they tell you?
Okay, well, I did talk about Marwan Jaber, the medical student that was in the hospital on April 7th. So again, what he told me was that they were treating, actually, this is interesting, he said, while staff were treating normal bombing injuries and bleeding cases, as he described them, asphyxiation, strangers entered screaming about a chemical attack, Kamawi, Kamawi, and started hosing people with water. And then he said hospital staff calmed the situation down and went back to treating the patients as normal shelling victims, as they didn't exhibit any indications of having been exposed to a chemical agent. So that was, a pretty damning testimony from somebody who was there.
In late 2019, when WikiLeaks published these internal documents from the OPCW showing that no chemical gas attack took place in Douma, how did it feel to have your reporting from a year and a half ago corroborated by the scientists who went to visit the site?
I mean, of course, it was very interesting to hear these people were speaking out, the OPCW whistleblowers were speaking out. But no, I'm sorry, I didn't expect, of course, mainstream media to give them any fair treatment. I expected either them to be derided, as anybody who speaks truthfully on Syria is, or simply to be ignored. Remembered, I wanted to make one point. So when I was in Eastern Ghouta in 2018, I also went to Kafr Batna for a different purpose. Because if you remember, in 2013, Syria was accused of using chemical weapons. And in Kafr Batna, at the tuberculosis hospital, there were scenes allegedly of chemical weapons victims being treated there. So when I went in May 2018, I spoke with the hospital administrator, Mr. Mohammed Al-Ahwani, and he told me there wasn't a chemical attack. He said he wasn't at the hospital that night, but his staff told him what happened. He said around 2 a.m., there was suddenly noise, shouting, cars arriving at the hospital, bringing civilians. Some people, armed men, said there was a chemical attack. Some of them had foreign accents, which is interesting. They took people's clothes off and started pouring water on them, very much like 2018. They kept bringing people in until 7 a.m. I thought that was quite interesting because, when that alleged attack occurred, it was coincidentally when OPCWs were already in Syria to investigate a prior allegation.
Ava, thanks for joining me. Thanks for your reporting. While Western governments and the Western mainstream media want you to believe that what's happening in Syria is a popular uprising or a revolution or an Arab Spring, the truth is far more sinister. When you have a dozen countries ganging up against Syria and funding armed terrorist groups and waging a massive disinformation campaign using a vast propaganda network, that's not a revolution anymore. That's not a popular uprising anymore. That's an imperialist war of aggression. The evidence behind the OPCW cover-up cannot be denied. The evidence behind the funding of these Western intelligence cutouts cannot be denied. The same people who lied to you about WMDs in Iraq, the same people who lied to you about Libya being liberated and turned a prosperous Arab African nation into a failed state, are also selling you these lies about Syria, and you should not believe them. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Nothing about the current COVID-19 explosion should come as a surprise. As the virus spread through summer and fall, experts repeatedly warned winter could be worse. They cautioned that a cold weather return to indoor socializing, particularly around the holidays, could turn a steady burn into a wildfire. Throw in a lame duck president, wildly differing approaches by the states, and a pervasive sense of quarantine fatigue, and a wildfire could easily become an inferno. Stay with us for an article written by Jamie DeCalm, a commentator and writer under the heading, "The US COVID-19 Outbreak is Worse Than It's Ever Been." Stay with us for more of Jamie DeCalm's article. The United States is now locked in a deadly cycle of setting, then shattering, records for new cases and hospitalizations. On 13th of November, staggering 177,224 people in the United States were diagnosed with COVID-19. As of 17th of November, more than 70,000 coronavirus patients were hospitalized nationwide. And unlike in earlier waves, which were fairly regionalized, the virus was, as of 17th of November, spreading and fast in virtually every part of the United States, according to Johns Hopkins University data. This coast-to-coast surge is pushing hospitals across the country to the edge of catastrophe, their doctors and nurses exhausted, and their intensive care units running dangerously low on beds. Some cities are already playing out their dystopian worst-case scenarios. In El Paso, Texas, for example, the dead have been shunted to mobile morgues, partially staffed by the incarcerated. But the U.S. public has become terrifyingly good at ignoring those harsh realities. Almost 40% of respondents to a recent Ohio State University survey say they plan to gather with at least 10 people for the Thanksgiving holiday, even though in many areas this comes with a likelihood of sharing a table with an infectious person. Many people continue to dine at indoor restaurants and work out in gymnasiums because the authorities continue to let them. Almost 980,000 people passed through the U.S. airport security checkpoints on 15th of November, nearly quadrupling the number recorded 6 months earlier, when COVID-19 was nowhere near as widespread as it is today. That people are behaving this way at the most dangerous moment of the US outbreak speaks volumes about human nature, which in the world of public health can be as dangerous as a variable as any pathogen. Rallying cries about flattening the curve have been replaced with a desire to return to normal life at all costs. Good news about promising COVID-19 vaccine candidates seems to be emboldening people in the wrong way. As Americans' reactions to the pandemic becomes increasingly divorced from the reality of it, public health officials may be facing their biggest challenge yet, forcing the American public to face how bad things still are and how much worse they can get. From a public health perspective, Thanksgiving was always going to be a problem. Maskless indoor gatherings in close quarters are perfect breeding grounds for the coronavirus, and many Thanksgiving celebrations will likely include older adults at high risk of severe COVID-19. After months of separation, it's natural that people are desperate to see loved ones and reclaim a sense of normality, but things are far from normal. More than half of the United States COVID-19 cases have been recorded since August, and the speed at which they're accumulating is ratcheting up. More than 1 million new cases were logged in just a week leading up to 17th of November. Nonetheless, people appear unwilling to take the kind of drastic measures that they did this spring, when lockdowns went into effect in many parts of the country and most people cut out socializing with anyone outside of their household. People may be inclined to travel because of a mistaken perception that the pandemic is better controlled now than it was earlier in the year. In mid-April, about 37% of the American public said they were very concerned they or someone they know would catch COVID-19. But on 17th of November, that number had dipped to less than 32%, despite the fact that case counts are now higher and more geographically diverse than they were back in April. A recent study found that people of all ages were more likely to partake in risky behaviors, like attending gatherings and seeing friends as the pandemic drags on. In the meantime, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has now authorized multiple drugs for treating COVID-19, and hospitals are reporting better survival rates among COVID-19 patients than they were this spring. But Dr. Megan Ranney, an emergency medicine physician from Brown University, says that could easily change if hospitals become overwhelmed, and many already are overwhelmed, and many more will be, as recently diagnosed patients get sicker in the coming weeks. Vaccines have also been a source of optimism lately. Pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Moderna each announced in November that their vaccine candidates are at least 90% effective at preventing COVID-19, setting off a flurry of positive headlines. But as of this writing, neither vaccine has yet been approved or granted emergency use authorization by the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. And even once they are, it will take months of doses to become available to most of the general public. According to Dr. William Moss, executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at Johns Hopkins University, the promising vaccine news doesn't mean that we can go back to our pre-pandemic lifestyles. We're going to have to continue our social distancing and wearing face masks for the foreseeable future until we get really high coverage with a vaccine that's highly protective and reduces transmission of the virus. but individual choices around wearing face masks and social distancing only go so far. In times of crisis, people turn to their leader for support and guidance. And on that front, U.S. officials are failing the public. The Trump administration has done very little to counter rampant misinformation about the coronavirus pandemic and has made numerous incorrect statements about the virus's origin, about its spread and deadliness. Dr. Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute, says the COVID-19 situation could be very different if they had a president and administration that were not going countercurrent to science and facts. From day one, Donald Trump and his team have basically not taken the coronavirus seriously. Now, with Donald Trump serving out the rest of his term as a lame duck president, the situation is particularly scary, Dr. Topol says. Trump has stopped attending White House coronavirus task force meetings and has said little about the current coronavirus surge gripping the country. State and local leaders have also been slow to re-implement lockdown measures that could help curb the virus's spread. Unlike in Europe, where some countries re-implemented restrictions of various levels in response to spiking case counts this autumn, many U.S. officials have been hesitant to snap regulations on reopened businesses.
It seems that even when Britain is down on its knees, it receives yet another kick in the teeth to make sure it won't get up again. The acclaimed and once respected British retail industry has seen two of its super heavyweights each receive a knockout blow to go with the rest of the nation, as both have collapsed dramatically within a day of each other. After 242 years of trading on the British High Street, what started off as a single store in London, well-known brand Debenhams has collapsed, putting at risk thousands of jobs and seeing 124 stores set to close for good, leaving a significant gap in the retail areas of the UK. Joining Debenhams and collapsing just the day before is the Arcadia Group, which owns the likes of Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins and Evans, and will see 13,000 employees looking for work as Christmas approaches and a grim year comes to an end.
What all retailers need to understand, and some do it better than others, is that we need to have a reason to visit their stores. So I think as one of the lessons from this, although sadly, yeah, for the workforce at Arcadia, that might not apply so much, but for the industry, one of the lessons is that your store estate has got to be great. It's got to inspire, it's got to excite, and it's got to draw people in.
Between Debenhams and Arcadia, some 25,000 people will now join the unemployment figures that Britain is already suffering with. And alarmingly, with the majority of staff in the retail sector fairly unskilled, the prospects of a new job are far from a reality. Yet it's not just the retail sector that has suffered in Britain, with many other industries and big names collapsing in 2020, in part due to the COVID-19 virus, but also thanks to the disastrous handling of Brexit, which has seen many low-skilled workers flee the UK into richer European markets, leaving a gap in the labour market that's simply not being filled by the British. What now remains to be seen is whether the introduction of the upcoming vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech, which has just been approved by the British government, will come in time to save the other few remaining retail outlets that are hanging on by a thread as Brexit fast approaches, the COVID-19 pandemic peaks at its second wave, and the people and institutions of Britain are left on a knife edge as uncertainty reigns over the country. The next 36 hours will be crucial as Michel Barnier continues to work around the clock to put pressure on the British negotiating team to accept the terms and conditions being imposed by the EU. With Barnier in constant liaison with the 27 remaining EU states as to the progress of the talks, of which he holds the power of attorney on behalf of the EU. Yet in spite of multiple rounds of talks, Barnier remains far from optimistic that a deal can be done, and has warned the EU nations to face the very real prospect that Britain will leave the EU with no deal, leaving trade and commerce to continue under WTO rules, which will no doubt be far more painful for Britain than it will for the EU. Many EU nations have stated that they support Barnier and are insisting that he remain tough to the end, suggesting that under no circumstances should he compromise with the British to allow a deal to go through, unless it fully benefits the EU, with France leading the resistance and seeing backing from many other European superpowers.
Und ich wünsche Michel Barnier und gegebenenfalls auch Ursula von der Leyen viel Kraft und viel Geschick für die letzten Verhandlungsschritte. Wir brauchen aber auch kein Abkommen um jeden Preis. Das haben wir deutlich gemacht. Wir wollen eins, aber wir werden sonst auch Maßnahmen ergreifen, die notwendig sind. Auf jeden Fall liegt ein Abkommen im Interesse aller.
So clear is the obvious lack of leadership displayed by the British negotiating team and the Conservative government of Boris Johnson, who so eagerly fought for Brexit, that the people of Britain are also waking up to the reality of the impact of Brexit, such as the collapse of the British retail industry, with many in Britain now showing signs that they're worried about what the future may hold for the tiny island nation. What is guaranteed is that Britain can no longer put all the blame on the COVID-19 virus for its disastrous year, and must now finally acknowledge that without the EU powerhouse to prop it up, Britain is weak and is falling faster than a house of cards. Death to America and Israel, with the Iranian lawmakers chanting condemnation of the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The day started with the passing of a draft bill at Iran's parliament. This was the first retaliation by Iran after the assassination of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The provisions that were passed, which still need to be approved before turning into law, were the backbone of the JCPOA, hard-fought in negotiations between Iran and the world powers. Some of the provisions that were passed by Iran's parliament include the enrichment of uranium up to 20% level and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to launch a plant to produce metal uranium in Esfahan. It would also revive heavy water reactor within 2 to 4 months. The number of centrifuges would also increase. This would be a clear blow to the IAEA and the world powers, since Iran has been compliant in working with the organization. But Parliament has also sent a 3-month deadline for it to stop applying additional protocols of the IAEA, a draft bill that will also require the Iranian government to stop any IAEA inspections beyond additional protocol. All of this should sound familiar, since they were part of the JCPOA. But now, Iran is arguing that enough is enough. The JCPOA wasn't even fully operational, and that it had become a tool for the European signatories to apply pressure on Iran, whilst allowing the EU to remain on the fence when it came to treading between Iran and the United States.
Well, ever since the United States, at the behest of Donald Trump, left the JCPOA, and I believe that's about 2.5 years ago, there has been repeated urgings by the European powers that are still in the agreement and the other powers that are still in the agreement to wait, to beseeching Iran to wait, that they'll do something, they'll take measures to help relieve the problem of the sanctions imposed by the United States. But as far as we can see, very, very little has happened. So it comes to a point where now we have another assassination of a leading scientist, leading official. We have word from Washington that the Trump administration and Trump himself is thinking, can we have a military strike on Iran? So, you know, given these circumstances, I don't think that the Iranian government had any choice but to take further action.
When the US pulled out of the JCPOA under the executive order of Donald Trump, the EU stated that they would remain committed to the accord and continue to respect the terms and conditions of the agreement. Yet, the EU have simply used their rhetoric to sit neatly on the fence and neither respect or disregard issues such as trade, sanctions, and diplomacy with Iran. Yet, with Donald Trump still at the helm at the White House, at least until January, the EU must now start to lobby support from President-elect Joe Biden, which is something that should not be too difficult, as Biden himself has stated that he would like to re-enter the JCPOA once he takes office. Yet for Iran, the options that lie ahead are plentiful when it comes to managing how it will emerge from the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and how it plays out its diplomatic options in the future, with the expansion of its peaceful civilian nuclear program being just the first step. But what other options then could Iran also choose?
Well, for one thing, Iran could have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors leave. The inspectors, ever since the JCPOA was put into place in 2015, they have over and over and over again stated that Iran is meeting all the conditions of the JCPOA. But why would Iran continue to meet the conditions of the JCPOA when other countries are not? And when their adherence to the conditions of the JCPOA, the Iranian government's adherence to them, has not produced anything that is helpful to Iran. And in fact, the situation has gone downhill.
Does this then mean that the Israeli regime has shot itself in the foot by assassinating Fakhrizadeh? Already many nations across the globe have condemned the act, and the consequences now mean that Iran has the upper hand. Should the future lead to the negotiating table, with Iran able to cite the illegal actions of the Israeli regime as a key reason to undermine the Zionist government of Netanyahu and co. For Iran, as a force for peace in the region and the rest of the world, the time has come for it to progress into the future, having defiantly beaten the maximum pressure policy imposed by Trump, and show the world that it's a cooperative partner. Yet should the need arise, it can still continue on its very capable path without relying on any other nation in the process. As the people and officials of Iran turned out to pay their respects to the assassinated nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the evidence surrounding the murder began to come to light as more and more clues began to emerge about the circumstances that led up to the killing. Various voices have sent messages of condolences to Iran, as well as to the family and friends of Fakhrizadeh, coupled with strong words of condemnation over the assassination by the likes of the European Union, Hamas, Hezbollah, as well as countries like the United Arab Emirates, China, Jordan, and the UK. Yet again, in circumstances similar to the assassination of Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, or Arbitrary Executions has stated that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh constituted as an extrajudicial killing, suggesting foul play was at the heart of the act. It seems that further evidence has emerged that following the information revealed to Press TV, indications are pointing towards equipment being used in the attack originating from the Israeli regime's arsenal, with senior Iranian officials also stating that the technology used to commit the act was complicated and used remote devices, raising the question as to why the global arena is not calling for this crime to be investigated.
Israelis, they have the capacity and expertise in this. They have done it before. They have assassinated, with the help of the United States, some other Iranian scientists. And they have the motivation. They can gain from this assassination. So there are many reasons to say that Israelis, maybe with the help of Americans, they have done it. Whether other countries, including some of their Arab allies, are also involved in this or not, that's the question, and I think after the investigation and official conclusion, we might be hearing about this from Iranian officials. And according to that conclusion, I think we might be seeing a reaction from Iranian side.
As usual, the Israeli regime has remained eerily silent over the assassination, suggesting by the silence that they have too much to hide, which is not uncommon, as the regime have remained coy on numerous occasions in the past when it comes to the assassination of targets by the Zionist regime. Yet even if the Israelis are not responsible for pulling the trigger, the apparent use of satellite technology to activate the devices used clearly shows some notion of state-sponsored activity, and likely sees the Israeli regime's criminal counterparts from the MEK also play a part in the logistics and execution of the act in Iran, something that again bears all the common denominators of a Zionist plot. Tension appears to have risen in the recent weeks following the US elections, especially in parts of West Asia, where traditional allies to the US have started to express concerns that they'll not receive preferential treatment during the next US government's term in office. The emerging evidence that shows the weaponry used in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh had the hallmarks of Israeli origin suggests that the murder was not solely aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic of Iran pursuing its legitimate and peaceful civilian nuclear program, but was really an act of extreme provocation. A recent meeting in the Saudi region of Neom between Mike Pompeo, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Mohammed bin Salman, which has been denied by some, suggests that the planned assassination of Fakhrizadeh was discussed at the meeting, putting the three states on high alert prior to the action. With all three regimes opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the notion of no smoke without fire has never been truer when it comes to this sensitive issue. Was it then the Israeli regime that masterminded the assassination, gaining a nod from its friends along the way? Iran's reaction has been one bearing revenge for the assassination of the esteemed nuclear scientist. Yet, revenge for Iran does not necessarily mean in a like-for-like form of self-defense. For Iran, the most powerful form of revenge could come in the form of a diplomatic card, with the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, for one, stating that Iran is far too wise to fall into the trap set by the Zionist regime to provoke Iran into starting a conflict.
I think Iran is in a situation whereby assumes any reaction or response to this assassination inevitable, because if it doesn't respond, it will make the other side to advance further, and that will encourage them to do further assassinations or actions against Iran. But any serious response also might have a risk of, let's say, chain of actions or reaction which might end in a conflict in the region.
With diplomacy on the table, the most painful strike to the murderous Zionist regime would be showing the world that as a peace-loving nation, the pen is mightier than the sword.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th, when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt, or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercker movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
The
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. And here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that is very important, and that question is the following. We know that in the Holy Quran, God says that He is the creator of all things. For example, in Surah Zumar, verse 62, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Allahu khaliqu kulli shay. God is the creator of all things. Or in Surah Mu'min, verse 62, Allah says, Zalikumullahu rabbukum khaliqu kulli shay. That is God, your Lord. the creator of all things. Other verses as well affirm this Quranic truth. At the same time, we know that we intuitively feel that we are the agent of the actions that we perform, that we cannot deny this. How can we reconcile these two principles with one another? It seems that we know that it's impossible for one effect to stem from two causes. This is something that is very self-evidently true. So how can we say that this effect is simultaneously the effect of God and the effect of